CZ Studio and Radio Verte presents The Wild Wind by Corey Zimmerman.
Chapter 4. The Bronson Building Day Room was where the patients could relax by one of the colossal windows, providing a magnificent view of the river valley below. They could listen to the phonograph, or read a book from the library, or eat its pages, play the piano, pound the keys, or if one chose, play chess, checkers, chew on the checkers, or an everlasting staring contest with the wall. The day room was full of a spectrum of characters, such as Jesse, a young man in a wheeled chair, who would grow frustrated watching the flies bump into the window, trying to escape the invisible wall preventing them from moving toward sunlight. The flies would grow somewhat disoriented as their confused visual signals miscalculated what they were seeing. The glass's smooth surface allowed the flies to hold on using the hairs on their sticky pads. However, as the glass prevents them from succeeding in escape, a sustained effort over time had finished off any reserved body fat, leaving them to lie dying of exhaustion. Jesse had watched the flies continually bouncing and buzzing against the glass for so long he was aware of their impending fate. This made him nervous, which caused him to squirm about anxiously in his wheeled chair, until it made the other patients nervous, who would call again and again on a nurse to open the window for the fly to escape. Another character, Big Ben, was a giant of a man, trapped inside a child's mind, or vice versa perhaps, a child trapped within a giant of a man. Despite his girth, Big Ben was a gentle soul, only one thing on his mind, and that was pie. He spent most of his days waiting for the pie to be served after dinner, and on one Thanksgiving, Ben dragged 6 male attendants across the dining room floor upon his belly, with nothing but the tips of his fingers, trying to gain access to the table of pies. He succeeded. There was Mabel, who suffered from the rare phobia of her own heartbeat, and frankly, that of her own existence. Her anxiety and clenched jaw had caused most of her molars to shatter. She spoke all of her thoughts aloud, pacing back and forth, muttering, my heart, it's going to stop. Someone please help me, my heart. Sir William, as he preferred to be called, was a young man in his early 30s, who spoke with a feigned British accent, and elected himself the caretaker of the grandfather clock, always making sure to keep it wound daily. In fact, he rarely left its side. Sir William would count the ticks and talks second after second, minute after minute, hour after hour, from sunrise until sunset, until he noticed its pace slowing even the slightest, a 32nd of a second. He then used the key he kept on the string around his neck to give the old clock a good old crank, counting the seconds to ensure the time was just right. And when asked why he did this, he would say, I got somewhere to be. Franklin, a simple old man, it was supposed on average, managed but one thought a minute. More often than not, that word was shouted aloud, and it was simply cow, 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 cow. Minute after minute, throughout the day, cow, 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 kill. Surprisingly perturbed no one, as it echoed throughout the day room, as he never attempted to kill anyone, nor could Franklin move an inch without assistance. Most assumed he had a previous life in a slaughterhouse. If one could hear the day room orchestra, it would have sounded something like this. 1, 2, 3, cow, oh my heart. 4, 5, 6, cow, oh my heart. 7, 8, 9, cow, oh my heart. 9, 10, 11, cow, somebody please help me, I got somewhere to be. 12, 13, kill, and so on. While an actual conversation may have sounded more like this, so nicely was it done that not a drop of blood was spilled. I only laid them to sleep. Snakes, 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 snakes. I don't know. I stuffed cotton in my ears not to hear them. My child is dead. My child is dead. I was elected by a majority of 64,000 votes, I tell you. My ears never stop ringing. They never stop ringing. I am a man, just like any other man. But well, you know I don't know how to explain it. But I suppose the gospel says so anyhow. I set a house on fire. That's the third house I've burnt. They didn't want to give me something to eat. I went off hungry and sat down and saw it burn. Somebody upstairs wants to kill me. Don't say anything to anyone. The day room was a noisy place, mostly when Slim was around. Slim believed everyone looked at him with wonder, as his tales and stories never ceased to amaze nor annoy. He had been a cowboy on the western plains, since he was old enough to straddle a bronco and throw a lasso, and was always spoiling for a fight in his youth. And Slim joined the militia the moment he thought there was a chance for active service in the war. He was one of those fellows, always guilty of some escapade. How he managed to get into the army, only a recruiting officer can tell. Slim would talk to anyone who would listen, and if there were no one around to listen, he would go on preaching as though he was preaching upon the hatch of a ship en route to war, with a crowd of eager young admirers surrounding him. Dr. Zola recorded one of Slim's sermons, and it sat in his case notes. "Shut up, you rookies. Don't you know an enlisted man got no right to laugh? You fellas are coming over here to get killed, I say, and my business is to haul your asses off the field and see your bodies properly thrown in a trench. Oh, I'll see your graves kept green. It's an easy job, seeing the grass sprouts almost before the earth done smooths over your grave. It's much pleasanter to be the burial corpse than to be the buried corpse." I told them, rookies. I tell you, it's a ticklish business. Driven over a rice field after a fight and not run over the fellas lying in the grass who is still alive. I know how it is myself. Being more in danger of being trampled to death by them mules than from the bullet that tore away half my face. Most of us that got hit got it right there in the noggin. It was afternoon, March, I recall. A little Filipino boy came crawling up from the river and told us there were damn near 100 Americans killed when suddenly the lights went out. You don't know when you're hit. Next thing I remember was waking up with a headache. When I put my hand in my head, I found only part of me was there. And the little boy, he said, "The soldiers all gone off." I looked around and couldn't see one of my comrades, and I knew they'd charged the line as they intended to before dark. Hell, the doctors wanted to cut out my tongue, but decided on the left eyeball instead. They said my jaw was sprung, so it would be impossible for me to subside on army ration. And they said my missing eye would prevent me ever again being a good marksman. But many a time I've thrown my hat in the air while in full gallop on the plains, and put all 6 of my Colt's bullets through it before it hit the ground. So hell, what do they know? You don't aim to do that. You just bring your gun in line with a jerk and pull the trigger. Now imagine the day room with Slim in your left ear and Raymond in your right. Raymond had been catatonic for over 30 years, decades before arriving at the hilltop. Raymond had no relatives and no visitors. Raymond usually sat in a chair, smoking a cigarette the nurses would place in his lips. But one random day, Raymond decided to stand up and talk. And just like that, every day thereafter, he chain-smoked his cigarettes in one drag as he rambled and rambled and rambled, leaving everyone yearning for the old catatonic who sat silent by the window. None of you jerks have a brain, but here y'all think I'm the stupid one because I want to sit here by the window where I can see the trees, hear the birds. I like the birds, but you fool creatures fail to understand that. I want peace. I just want peace and quiet. But no, everyone is always talking, 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 talking about nothing. Absolutely nothing of any substance at all. Shut up about the damn war. It's over. Get over it. Talk about something intriguing, entertaining, anything that doesn't make me want to saw off my own head. You could talk about the weather for all I give a damn. Or better yet, the birds. I can't even hear the birds singing over that damn yapping, yapping, yapping. We could all sit in silence and look at the trees. Now, is that not a glorious idea? Hell, let's name off every damn tree in the great state of Illinois, shall we? Silver maple, sugar maple, Ohio buckeye, horse chestnut, red buckeye, tree of heaven, Persian silk tree, devil's walking stick, river birch, paper birch, trumpet creeper, musselwood, bitternut hickory, pignut hickory, sweet hickory, shagbark hickory, American chestnut, redbud, dogwood, stiff dogwood, hazelnut, cockspur, hawthorn, Washington hawthorn, eastern leatherwood, autumn olive. Yeah, and we got the eastern wahoo, American beech, white ash, black ash, and the green ash, and the red ash, and the blue ash, honey locust, Kentucky coffee tree, Carolina silver ball, eastern red cedar, golden rain tree, sweet gum, the old wild crab tree, the prairie crab tree, cork tree, even the nine bark tree, and the jack pine, and the red pine, and the wine pine, and the white pine, sycamores, white poplar, cottonwood, big tooth aspens, wild plum, peach, the wild black cherry, the choke cherry, the wafer ash, black jack oak, got the dwarf oak, goat willow, pussy willow, blabbernut, northern white cedar, and the eastern hemlock, southern arrowwood, prickly ash, slippery elm, and the almighty American elm. And then there was Rose. Rose never said a word. Her body had long atrophied and doubled up, so she resembled more of a toad than a human being. She loved hopping around on her hands, however, chewing and spitting tobacco everywhere, which made at times a horrible mess to slip around in. So Rose spent most of her time sitting next to a spittoon on a mattress on the floor, having stripped off her gown in the warm rays of the sun. By the time Rose arrived at the hilltop, she had lived in the poorhouse for some 40 years. The first few, she lived in a basket lined with straw. And then after too many violent outbursts, she was confined to a locked crib, where she was cared for solely by other patients. Obsessed that Old Scratch was watching her, with her fingernails, she had scratched out her own eyes, and with her fists, beat her own face until her front teeth were missing. Rose had become a cursed and hideous object, hidden away in a dark and damp corner, with no ability to speak. Rose was quiet, and from what I gathered from her file, most likely didn't want to go to the dance at the pavilion that night, but her sisters had insisted. You see, Rose was a shy girl, but her mother held on to hope that she might meet a boy from a family who owned some land. So together, the family enticed her to attend the village social. Unfortunately for Rose, a combination of her odd disposition and her grandmother's penchant for witchcraft undoubtedly provided Rose an unfavorable reputation amongst the community, let alone any suitors. So her chances of meeting one were slim. But Rose was beautiful back then, a 17-year-old girl, though a bit awkward, very easy on the eyes. Easy enough, at least, for the boy who asked her to dance. Rose's sisters dropped their jaws as he whirled her around the stage in delight, and soon he pulled her by the hand off into the night, where he must have told Rose he adored her beautiful smile, anything to get a kiss of her sweet, succulent lips. Rose must have been surprised when he pulled his warm lips away to ask, "Is your soul as cold as they say?" Yet before she could answer, he laid her down in the straw of the old barn out back his house. He tore off his shirt, and she ran her fingers down his chest, then exposing her breast, of which he devoured like a hungry dog, just as his ma noticed a lantern aglow in the barn. The boy squirmed like a worm on top of Rose, unaware his ma had entered with a butcher knife. Rose screamed and covered herself, and crawled back into a corner as a slap came across the boy's face. Profanities flew, and his ma dragged him away by his ear as he made one excuse after another. He didn't even turn back, but his ma did. She stopped right at the barn door, looked Rose deep in the eye, and warned her never to return. Tears rolled down Rose's face as she put on her disheveled dress in the dark and walked home in shame. But something came over Rose, and the two continued to meet in secrecy until the day the boy asked for Rose's hand in marriage. A few days later, there was a knock on her door. "So you intend to marry my boy?" asked his mama, as Rose's sister spied from inside. Rose stood speechless. In a deep, dark, horrible tone, his ma threatened to curse Rose if she ever came near her boy again. Threats sank so deep into Rose's heart as she feared both the hoodoo and losing her husband-to-be. "I love him," Rose said. With a shriveled, snarling face, his ma then cursed. "If you ever even think of seeing my boy again, I'll send Old Scratch your way, and he will follow you to your grave. You'll never close your eyes without seeing his face again. Old Scratch, Old Scratch, Old Scratch." Rose fell to her knees in tears, and her sisters came out and stood silent. At sunset, Rose sat alone until midnight in the trees waiting for her love, but this time he never showed. She came again the following night, waiting in the dark as she chewed off her nails. On the third night, she wept until she thought she heard something, calling out his name, relieved to see him again. But a shadow crossed the corner of her eye, and it was then she spoke his name, Old Scratch. Rose jumped to her feet and ran all the way home. Startled, her sisters found her jumping on her bed, laughing hysterically. They told their mama Rose was spinning around on the floor, on her head like a top, repeating again and again, Old Scratch, Old Scratch, Old Scratch. Old Scratch. Old Scratch. Rose's disturbing behavior went on for days until it drove her ma to her wit's end, and she grabbed the shotgun and unloaded it from the front porch into the sky, screaming for Old Scratch to go on and get now. Nonetheless, a week later, Rose was sent off to the poorhouse. The interior of the poorhouse was as crisp as the air outside when Dr. Zola arrived. His breath was visible, although he quickly covered his face with his hands due to the awful stench permeating the air. A hall ran down each side of the building, the middle cells resembling a prison. Each was no larger than 4 by 6 feet. The doors made of a rough, hardwood plank, with a small bored hole in the center, which was the only source of light and air for those trapped inside. The beds were on the floor, with nothing to separate the inmates from where they sat except for a piece of plank set up edgewise. The whole construction, a stigma of humanity. There were 30 sleeping rooms, initially intended for one each, but were crowded with up to 5 inmates per damp, airtight cell, others as many as 7. Each in the greatest state of helplessness and dependence, many in a state of complete nudity, men, women, children, all living together in beds of straw, upon a damp, dirty floor, into which external light could find no entrance. Shocked by what he saw, Dr. Zella noted, he shall remember as long as he should live, those 120 doomed to that living tomb. Listless, idle, and useless, blue with cold, and utterly filthy in person, they lived in rows of which vermin scurried between, wretchedness in an atmosphere whose odor exceeds offensiveness, beyond which the imagination can conceive. A filthy naked woman curled up in a corner in a nest of straw screamed at the doctor, There's the son of a bitch that did me wrong. There's the son of a bitch that did me wrong. He then found another man who had been in a straitjacket for 6 weeks, and a woman who had been fastened to a bed for days. Yet she had the reasoning enough to plead, Please get me out of this. I need to see the doctor, please. He entered a dark room into which those deemed the lamest patients had been kept, where he discovered, chained to a wall by his ankle, a crippled teenage boy weighing no more than 100 pounds, having limbs about the thickness of a man's wrist, but bent and twisted. As Dr. Zola attempted to comfort the boy, he heard a rustling from the shadows, and as he looked in the back corner of the room, he barely spotted in the darkness a padlocked Utica crib. This is where he first found her, in that crib, covered partially by a canvas tarp, curled up inside of it, withered, gargoyle-like, crouched, a living mummy, skinny beyond any human comprehension, but impossibly alive. She was completely naked and filthy, her eyes missing, the sockets dark and bruised and empty. She was in constant motion, black and blue from head to toe. She laid in her own bed of straw, covered in her own feces. Horribly deformed, her knees almost touched her chin, as little mice and other vermin had nested at her side. He reached through the cage and touched her on the shoulder, and she jumped, making an inhuman sound. My darling, everything's going to be okay now. I am here to help you. It was just before 1 a.m. when the train from Davis County finally arrived at the asylum depot. The engine's headlight piercing the dark night as it approached, blinding the nurses with tired eyes, who awaited on the platform. They covered their ears as the whistle blew, and steam rose from the brakes of the screeching wheels, in the chill of the winter air. Exhausted, everyone did their best to organize the entirety of the Davis Poorhouse insane who stumbled off the train, yawning and rubbing their eyes, in poor and dismal condition, as the nurses ran to their assistance. A large and heavy clothes basket, assumed to contain all the effects of the newly arrived patients, required two male attendants to carry. As they carefully carried the basket up the long staircase that stretched up the hilltop, about halfway, the basket began to move, and when the mound of laundry began to shake, they each froze and looked at each other with the same look of shock as they dropped the basket and backed away, and with the ghastly sight of a filthy old skeleton sat up with a toothless shriek, eye sockets as dark as the night, hissing and clawing, they each fell back on their bottoms with a scream of terror, and a tale to be told for decades forth. The next morning, Rose awoke in a clean bed with white sheets near a sunlit window. From that very first day, Rose was very ornery. Still, each nurse cared for her every need with compassion and with admiration for such a resilient soul as hers. And upon her new bed, she sat like a strange species, grabbing and putting what she could into her mouth. Dr. Zola, however, was the only one who could calm Rose when she grew frustrated, as she responded amazingly to his voice and touch. And as each day passed, Rose looked remarkably better and warmed up to the others. She was eventually allowed to roam free, and she did, usually in search of her one true love, chewing tobacco. And in time, Rose would become the most pleasant patient in the chaos of the day room.